The Federal News Update for Monday, October 20th, 2025. I'm your guide, Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
And today we're doing a deep dive into, well, frankly, an extraordinary 48 hours, Saturday, October 19th and Sunday, October 20th, a time when the U.S. federal government was operating under, let's just say, acute institutional stress.
Acute is putting it mildly, Alex. What we're looking at here, based on everything we've gathered, it goes far beyond what you might think of as a normal government shutdown, if there even is such a thing anymore.
Right.
Our sources are really detailing a period where Congress was effectively absent, just not there, and the executive branch seemed to seize that vacuum quite strategically.
So not just a funding lax, but a calculated opportunity.
Exactly. It looks like a concerted maneuver, really, playing out on both the domestic and international stages. And it fundamentally tested the constitutional separation of powers, you know, while also taking aim squarely at the professional civil service.
Okay, so that's our mission for this deep dive. We want to give you an absolutely exhaustive, really granular look at pretty much every significant action and activity of the U.S. federal government, starting from Saturday, October 19th.
Yeah, and we've sort of identified four crises that were unfolding all at once, interlocking in some ways.
And they reveal this pattern, it seems, where the executive branch is actively, maybe even deliberately, weaponizing the failure of the legislative branch to achieve its own long-term structural goals.
That's the core of it. We need to understand not just the what happened, but the why it matters, why these specific events could be really foundational for, well, the immediate future of how government works in the U.S.
It's a difference between political theater, maybe, and actually reshaping the administrative state.
Right. Temporary posturing versus permanent architecture. And I think we have to start right there on the domestic front. How this funding crisis, this shutdown, was seemingly engineered into something much bigger, a tool for ideological change.
Okay, let's set the scene then. October 19th, that's Saturday. The government shutdown that had started back on October 1st was already entering its third week.
3 long weeks. And the root cause, on the surface, was this legislative stalemate over the annual appropriations bills.
The sticking point being the Democratic demand to keep the Affordable Care Act, the ACA health care subsidies, going as they were set to expire.
And the Republican House leadership flatly refusing to include that funding. That was the deadlock.
But the context here, the part that sometimes gets lost, is that Congress itself wasn't even really in Washington to negotiate.
Exactly. That's crucial. The legislative branch, the one with the constitutional power of the purse, was effectively AWOL. Both the House and the Senate were in a scheduled district work period.
They went home while the government was shut.
They went home. Which created this profound power vacuum right in the heart of D.C.
And that vacuum, you're saying, is what the executive branch stepped into?
Aggressively. It allowed the administration to interpret its authority under the Anti-Deficiency Act in a, let's say, highly creative way. Historically, that act is about managing temporary funding gaps, usually leading to furloughs. Non-essential functions stop.
Right. Temporary unpaid leave. That's the usual drill.
But the interpretation of essential versus non-essential became the key. And the administration under President Trump used that ambiguity, it appears, to justify a really unprecedented expansion of executive power, twisting the act's purpose.
Which brings us straight to what you call the executive gambit. This is where the shutdown narrative really shifted, isn't it? From temporary pain to potentially permanent change.
Absolutely. This was the pivot. Forget furloughs, that temporary leave with the expectation of back pay once funding returns. That script was thrown out.
So what happened instead?
The administration made what our sources call a stark and unprecedented departure from all historical practice. Instead of furlough notices, they started issuing permanent reduction in force notices. RFs.
RFs. I mean, layoffs, right? Termination.
That's exactly what it means. It's the end of your federal employment. Not a pause, not a temporary inconvenience. It's being fired.
And this wasn't just happening randomly. There was a strategy.
Oh, very much so. We have granular detail on this. The Office of Management and Budget Director, Russ Vaught, who is known to be closely aligned with the Project 2025 transition plans, he issued a specific memo.
What did the memo say?
It explicitly directed federal agencies to use the shutdown period as an opportunity to identify programs and the people working in them that were considered inconsistent with the administration's priorities, think Project 2025 goals, and target them for these RAFs.
Wow. So weaponizing the lack of funding to reshape the bureaucracy itself.
Precisely. It moves way beyond just managing a budget gap. It's ideological restructuring dressed up as fiscal necessity.
Do we know how many people were affected initially?
The numbers were significant even early on. Our sources indicate that by the weekend before the one we're focusing on, so October 11th and 12th, over 4,100 federal workers had already received these permanent layoff notices.
4,100. That's substantial.
And Vaught himself publicly suggested that was just the beginning. He hinted the final number could easily top 10,000 employees.
So let's spell this out for, you know, for anyone listening. This fundamentally changes what a shutdown means. It's not just political hardball overspending levels anymore.
Not at all. It became an active, functional tool for what some are calling a permanent purge or an ideological cleansing of the bureaucracy. They weren't just pausing work they deemed non-essential. They were using the shutdown as sort of legal cover to systematically dismantle functions they oppose.
Like environmental regulation, maybe?
Right. Civil rights
enforcement. Exactly, those kinds of areas. Yeah. Regulatory functions, scientific research, consumer protection areas, often seen as conflicting with certain administration goals. Mm-hmm. And when you issue a RIF, you're not just losing an employee.
You lose their expertise, their experience.
Institutional memory, specialized knowledge, established networks. It's designed to cripple the government's capacity to carry out policies the administration disagrees with long after the shutdown itself ends. A permanent reshaping. But this level of executive action, this aggression, surely it didn't go unchallenged.
It absolutely did not. And the challenge came swiftly. And from the third branch of government, the judiciary.
The court stepped in.
Immediately. Federal employee unions like AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, and AFSCME, they filed suit almost right away.
And what was the outcome?
On October 15th, just before the weekend we're focusing on, but the impact really solidified during these 48 hours, U.S. District Judge Susan Yvonne Ilston, out in the Northern District of California, issued a temporary restraining order, a TRO.
A TRO, that sounds serious. It's an emergency measure, right? What did it do?
It was a direct halt. It explicitly blocked the Trump administration from issuing or implementing any more of these RIF notices nationwide.
Nationwide, so a complete stop?
But for the time being, yes. Judge Ilston's ruling sided unequivocally with the unions. She found the whole RIF process was deeply flawed, likely illegal, and pretty clearly politically motivated.
Did she use strong language?
Remarkably strong. She called the administration's approach ready, fire, aim, basically saying they rushed to fire people without proper process or justification. She stated very clearly that the human cost of these actions cannot be tolerated.
What was the core legal argument from the unions? Why are RIFs different from furloughs in the eyes of the court?
The key difference is irreparable harm. With a furlough, employees generally expect back pay eventually. It's disruptive, but temporary. Our RIF is permanent termination. You lose your job, your benefits, your health insurance, potentially your home. That's harm the court found couldn't just be fixed later with money. It's immediate and potentially catastrophic for the employees.
So beyond just protecting those specific jobs, what's the bigger constitutional significance of this TRO?
It's a fundamental assertion of judicial authority against what the court saw as executive overreach. It basically said, Mr. President, you cannot just dismantle the government structure using a funding crisis as a pretext. It reaffirmed that laws like the Administrative Procedure Act and civil service protections still apply, even during a shutdown.
So, a check on power.
A critical check. It defined the limits. It elevated the conflict from just a political spat over funding into a full-blown constitutional confrontation involving all three branches of government.
Okay, so while the executive and judiciary were battling over the power to fire federal workers, the rest of the federal government, the parts still technically operating or trying to, were experiencing the direct impact of the shutdown itself.
Yes, the operational disruption caused by having hundreds of thousands of workers furloughed, even without the immediate RIF threat hanging over everyone thanks to the TRO, was profound over that weekend, October 19th and 20th.
Let's dig into that. We need to really show the depth of this crisis, agency by agency. How does it affect public services and safety?
Well, let's start with regulation. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Sources say it furloughed about 89% of its staff. Nearly 9 out of 10 people gone.
89%. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means the EPA's core mission basically stopped. Enforcement inspections for major polluters halted. Reviewing applications for new environmental permits needed for construction or expansion, suspended. It creates this massive backlog, delays business, and critically leaves potential environmental hazards completely unmonitored.
Okay, what about communications, the FCC?
Similar story. the Federal Communications Commission furloughed around 88% of its workforce.
And the impact there.
It slows down the entire tech and broadcast sector. The FCC handles licenses for TV and radio stations, certifies new gadgets before they can be sold, manages the wireless spectrum that our phones rely on. With almost 90% of staff out, granting new licenses, approving new tech, managing that spectrum demand, it all just ceases. Business innovation gets stalled.
Now, market stability. That's always a huge concern during shutdowns, the SEC.
The Securities and Exchange Commission was operating with what sources called a skeleton crew. Now, the basic electronic filing system, EDGR, that stayed online, companies could still submit documents. But the SEC staff weren't there to review them. They couldn't review filings for new stock offerings, couldn't provide essential guidance for mergers or acquisitions, couldn't declare registration statements effective so companies could actually raise capital.
So uncertainty for the markets.
Exactly. As the source material puts it, it injected significant uncertainty into capital markets. If your company needed to issue bonds or go public over that weekend, you were basically stuck in limbo, a real risk for economic activity.
And then there's national security. This sounds alarming. The National Nuclear Security Administration, the NNSA.
This is deeply concerning. The NNSA is responsible for maintaining the safety, security, and effectiveness of the entire U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile.
And they furloughed how many?
80%. 4 out of 5 employees.
Why so high? Aren't they essential?
They are, but they apparently ran out of money faster than some other agencies. They'd used up their available carryover funds, those small reserves meant for short gaps. So 80% had to be furloughed.
What does that do to nuclear safety?
It means you suspend most of the routine stockpile maintenance programs. You halt critical scientific research needed to ensure the weapons remain reliable. You stop global security programs designed to prevent nuclear materials from falling into the wrong hands. This isn't just pushing paperwork, it's delaying vital, time-sensitive maintenance schedules for the nuclear triad. That has long-term readiness implications.
And even the military itself faced pay issues.
Yes. The active duty military only got their mid-October paychecks because the administration controversially reallocated about $8 billion from other Pentagon accounts.
Controversially.
Because it raised immediate questions about violating the Anti-Deficiency Act again. Moving money around that Congress hasn't specifically appropriated, even for something as essential as military pay, requires tricky legal justifications. It bypasses Congress's power of the purse and adds to the institutional stress.
Okay, so major regulatory bodies, market oversight, nuclear security, even military pay. What about more direct public services? Things people interact with daily.
The disruption hit there, too. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, had reduced inspections for routine domestic food and medical products. That's a direct safety concern.
Less checking on food safety.
Fewer routine checks, yes. National parks remain technically open but largely unstaffed, which raises safety issues for visitors and risks damage to the parks themselves.
And things like loans or Social Security.
Big delays. People trying to get federal housing loans, FHA, or small business loans, SBA, faced major processing stalls. Even getting something simple but vital, like a replacement Social Security card, faced significant delays.
So it's not abstract. These aren't just numbers. It's hitting environmental safety, market confidence, national defense, and basic public services people rely on.
Exactly. It's tangible. The government isn't just closed in some theoretical sense. Its core functions, the ones that provide safety, economic stability, and daily necessities, were actively failing or severely stressed. The basic contract between the state and the citizen was fraying.
And while all this operational chaos was unfolding, the political blame game was in full swing over the weekend, wasn't it? Setting the tone for the week ahead.
Oh, absolutely. The rhetoric was sharp and highly polarized, as you'd expect.
What were the Democrats saying?
Democratic leaders like House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and Representative Susan Delbene were squarely blaming the GOP and the White House. They accused President Trump of being radio silent on any real negotiations.
And Delbene made the point about who controls Washington.
Right. She emphasized that Republicans run the House and the White House. So in her words, everything is on them. They couldn't shift the blame for the government being shut down.
How did the Republicans, particularly Speaker Johnson, respond to that?
Speaker Johnson stuck to the party line. He dismissed the Democrats' insistence on funding the ACA subsidies as just a political stunt. He framed it as the Democrats attaching a poison pill to essential funding bills, thereby forcing the shutdown themselves, trying to flip the responsibility.
So basically, each side blaming the other for the gridlock. Any signs of a potential way out? Any cracks in the partisan wall?
There was one small but maybe notable glimmer. Senator Katie Britt, a Republican from Alabama, publicly stated she was actually open to talking about extending those ACA subsidies.
Oh, interesting. A potential bridge.
Potentially. But she attached some pretty big caveats. She said only after the government was reopened and only if significant conditions were met, things like strict income caps for the subsidies and new measures to reduce fraud.
So not exactly throwing the doors open, but maybe cracking it slightly.
Exactly. It was the first real hint from the Republican side of a possible off-ramp, even if it was heavily conditional and down the road.
Now, amidst all this finger-pointing and operational meltdown, there was another major controversy brewing, specifically involving the Department of Homeland Security. This really caught fire over the weekend.
Yes, the DHS spending controversy. The optics on this one were, well, astonishing, especially given that thousands of DHS workers, including Coast Guard members, were either furloughed or working without pay.
What was the specific issue?
Our sources reported on Sunday that the U.S. Coast Guard, which falls under DHS, had finalized a contract on Friday, right in the thick of the shutdown, to buy two brand new Gulfstream G700 private jets.
Private jets. How much are we talking?
Over $170 million for two jets. And their stated purpose was for the official travel of top DHS Political Leadership Secretary Kristi Noem and Deputy Secretary Troy Edgar.
Wow. $170 million for executive travel while rank and file are unpaid. How did the Coast Guard justify that?
Their official line focused on modernization and mission readiness. They argued the existing fleet was old, needed too much maintenance, and these new jets were essential for ensuring the top leaders could travel reliably for crucial national security missions. The acting commandant, Admiral Lunde, tried to frame it as an operational necessity.
I can imagine the political reaction was less understanding.
Immediate and scathing, particularly from Democrats. House Appropriations Ranking Member Rosa DeLauro, along with Representatives Lauren Underwood and Benny Thompson, were furious. They called the purchase vile, inappropriate, and raised serious questions about its legality.
Legality? On what grounds?
They questioned the funding source. Where did this $170 million suddenly come from during a shutdown, especially when Congress hadn't specifically approved it? Congressman Thompson was particularly blunt.
What did he say?
He called the purchase of multiple luxury jets while workers were unpaid blatantly immoral and probably illegal. He pointed out that Congress had actually rejected a smaller $50 million request for a similar jet earlier that year.
So it looked like they were bypassing congressional intent.
That was exactly the charge. It fed this narrative that the administration was prioritizing the perks and comfort of its political appointees over the basic needs of its workforce and, potentially, over the law regarding appropriations. A really stark example of perceived misplaced priorities during a crisis.
It really highlights that governance by crisis theme you mentioned. Okay, let's pivot now. We've covered the domestic chaos, the RIFs, the TRO, the agency breakdowns, the political fighting. But you said this was playing out on the international stage, too.
Yes, concurrently. And just as aggressively, in some ways, we saw a major diplomatic flashpoint ignite with a key U.S. ally in Latin America.
Colombia. What happened there?
This unfolded mainly on Sunday, October 19th. President Trump launched what sources described as a sudden and aggressive verbal assault on Colombia and its president, Gustavo Petro.
An assault? What kind of language are we talking about?
Highly inflammatory, deeply personal, and way outside normal diplomatic channels. Trump called Colombia a drug manufacturing machine. He didn't stop there. He personally labeled President Petro an illegal drug leader, a lunatic, and even a drug dealer.
Wow. Attacking a sitting head of state like that, that's unusual.
Extremely unusual, especially for such a close historical ally. But it wasn't just rhetoric. It came with immediate, concrete threats.
That's like what?
Trump declared an immediate halt to all financial assistance and subsidies going to Colombia. This is aid that supports everything from counter-narcotics efforts to economic development. And crucially, he announced his intent to impose new significant tariffs on all Colombian exports to the U.S., promising a formal announcement very soon.
So cutting off aid and threatening a trade war basically overnight, what sparked this sudden hostility?
The immediate trigger seems to have been escalating friction over recent U.S. military actions in the Caribbean, specifically targeting alleged drug trafficking operations.
Ah, related to the shutdown impact on, say, Coast Guard operations.
Possibly indirectly, but more directly, it was linked to a specific incident. On October 17th, just a couple of days prior, a U.S. military strike hit a boat suspected of drug trafficking, killing three individuals who were later identified as being affiliated with the ELN.
The ELN. That's a leftist guerrilla group in Colombia, right?
Correct. And President Petro reacted furiously to this strike. He disputed the U.S. justification, accused the U.S. government of committing murder, and claimed it was a violation of Colombian sovereignty. He framed the whole U.S. war on drugs as a dangerous excuse for unilateral military action.
Okay, so there was friction, but Trump's reaction seems incredibly disproportionate. What are the strategic implications of attacking Colombia like this? They're a major partner, aren't they?
Huge partner. Decades of security cooperation, major trading relationship. This risks fracturing that entire partnership. By attacking Petro personally and hitting Colombia with immediate economic threats aid cuts, tariffs, the administration essentially forces Bogota to rethink its entire relationship with Washington.
Pushing them away?
Potentially pushing them towards other partners. Colombia exports a lot of commodities. If the U.S. market suddenly becomes hostile or unreliable due to tariffs, guess who looks like a more stable economic partner? China is the obvious alternative. They'd be more than happy to deepen economic ties. So this kind of action could inadvertently diminish U.S. influence significantly in Latin America, creating a vacuum that rivals will eagerly fill. It looks like, frankly, strategic self-sabotage fueled by impulsive rhetoric.
And this Colombian confrontation is tied into that broader context of U.S. military actions in the Caribbean, the counter-narcotics strikes.
Absolutely. That October 17th lethal strike against the ELN-affiliated boat wasn't an isolated incident. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth publicly confirmed it happened within the U.S. Southcom area of operations.
And the administration's justification for using lethal force.
Their legal argument rests on claiming the U.S. is essentially in a low-intensity armed conflict with drug cartels and associated groups like the ELN. This, they argue, allows the military to use force unilaterally under self-defense doctrines and inherent war powers without needing specific congressional authorization for each strike.
That sounds like a controversial legal position. Was there pushback internally?
Significant pushback, it appears. Right around this time, we saw the announcement of the abrupt early retirement of Admiral Alvin Halsey.
He's the 4-star Navy admiral heading U.S. Southern Command, right? The command responsible for that region.
Exactly. His retirement was announced as effective in December, a full 2 years ahead of schedule, and multiple sources reported this was due to a fundamental conflict with Secretary Hegseth over the legality and the strategic wisdom of these lethal boat strikes.
So the top commander in the region might have been forced out over disagreements on this policy.
That's certainly the strong implication. An admiral doesn't typically retire 2 years early without a major reason. It signals serious dissent and instability right at the top of the military chain of command regarding this aggressive counter-narcotic strategy, especially as operations seem to be increasing near places like Venezuela.
Did this legal debate reach Congress? Any lawmakers weighing in?
Yes, and notably, criticism came even from within the president's own party. Senator Rand Paul was quite vocal.
What was his argument?
Paul questioned the fundamental legality and morality of it. He argued that these strikes go against all our tradition. He said, essentially, that unless you're in a declared war, you shouldn't be killing people without knowing who they are, without evidence presented in some kind of process. He drew a sharp line between targeted strikes against known terrorists in a conflict zone and, as he put it, blowing people up without us knowing their name, without any evidence of a crime.
So he challenged the administration's claim of being in an armed conflict with cartels that justifies military force.
Precisely. It highlights this deep tension between executive claims of authority to act unilaterally against perceived threats and the constitutional role of Congress in declaring war, alongside basic principles of due process and international law.
Okay, so we have this incredible mix. Domestic shutdown chaos, a judicial battle over firing federal employees, international diplomatic blowups, and controversial military actions. But you mentioned something else happening, something quieter but maybe more structurally significant.
Yes. While all this loud, chaotic activity was going on, the administration was also moving forward with the quiet, bureaucratic work of cementing political control over the government itself. This culminated on Monday, October 20th, with the official publication of Executive Order 14356.
Executive Order 14356. What was that about?
This EO is arguably the single most consequential institutional action taken during this 48-hour window. Its title was innocuous enough. Ensuring continued accountability in federal hiring. but its substance. It's essentially the architectural blueprint for achieving long-term political capture of the federal bureaucracy.
Political capture. How does an executive order on hiring achieve that? Let's get into the mechanics.
It works through a few key mechanisms designed to insert political control right at the very beginning of the hiring process, effectively bypassing the traditional merit-based system.
Okay, what's the first mechanism?
First, it imposes a government-wide hiring freeze on civilian positions, with very limited exceptions. Now, hiring freezes aren't unheard of, especially during transitions, but this sets the stage by creating scarcity and centralizing control over any hiring that does happen.
Makes sense. What's next?
Second, and this is the really radical part, potentially the biggest change to civil service hiring since the Pendleton Act over a century ago, it mandates the creation of new strategic hiring committees within every single federal agency.
Strategic hiring committees, who sits on those? HR professionals?
Absolutely not. That's the key. The order mandates these committees be composed primarily of senior political leadership within the agency. Think the deputy secretary, the chief of staff, other high-level political appointees selected by the administration.
So political appointees get to decide who gets hired?
They get the final say on every vacancy. The order states these committees must review and approve the justification for filling any position, regardless of the job level or whether it's, say, a highly technical scientific role or an administrative one.
Wait, so even if a division needs a career scientist or an expert analyst, the political leadership has to sign off before they can even post the job?
Precisely. It adds this thick layer of political oversight right at the front end, before the traditional merit-based process of reviewing qualifications even really begins.
And there's a third piece.
Yes. The order explicitly ties hiring decisions to political alignment. It requires that any hiring must be aligned explicitly with the priorities of my administration.
Explicitly. So it's not about finding the most qualified person anymore.
The emphasis shifts dramatically. It transforms the hiring goal from finding the best candidate based on skills and experience to finding a candidate whose views, or at least perceived loyalty, aligns with the current administration's political agenda.
Now, some sources compared this EO 14356 to the controversial Schedule F proposal from the first Trump term. How do they relate? Schedule F was about firing people, wasn't it?
Correct. Schedule F was designed as a tool for a retroactive purge. It aimed to reclassify tens of thousands of existing career civil servants, particularly those in policy-related roles, into a new category where they could be fired essentially at will, stripping them of normal civil service protections.
So Schedule F was about making it easier to fire current employees. How is EO 14356 different?
EO 14356 is about forward-looking institutional capture. It doesn't directly touch the protections of current career employees. Instead, it focuses on controlling the pipeline of new hires. The idea seems to be that as current employees retire, quit, or are perhaps removed through things like RIFs, every single person replacing them will have passed through this political filter first.
So over time, the bureaucracy gets remade in the administration's image higher by higher.
That appears to be the long-term strategy. It's a way to erode the merit-based nonpartisan civil service gradually from the inside out, ensuring future alignment. You could see the RIFs as the immediate shock and EO 14356 as the long-term institutional rewiring, a two-pronged approach to politicization.
It's fascinating, though, that while this machinery for political control was being formally put in place, other parts of the government just kept running.
That's the striking contrast, isn't it? Also published in the Federal Register on that same Monday, October 20th, was a completely routine presidential notice.
What did it do?
It simply continued the national emergency related to the situation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC, for another year. This is something legally required, dating all the way back to 2006 under President Bush.
So a standard piece of bureaucratic machinery grinding on.
Exactly. It's a perfect example of the resilience of the non-political institutional posts of the state. The career staff at the State Department, the National Security Council, they just keep doing their jobs, executing these complex, legally mandated functions, even with all the political chaos swirling around them, even with the threat of RIFs or political hiring committees looming.
It's almost a quiet testament to the very system that EO 14356 seems designed to undermine.
It really highlights the professionalism and dedication of those career employees, yeah? Shows the system hasn't entirely collapsed despite the immense pressures.
Okay, let's round out this intense 48-hour period. We need to talk about the political fallout and some other executive actions that happened over that weekend, starting with the public reaction, those big protests.
Yes, the No Kings protests on Saturday, October 19th, were significant. Reports indicate millions of people participated in something like 2,600 separate demonstrations across all 50 states.
What were they protesting specifically? The shutdown? The RIFs?
It seemed to be a combination of things: frustration with the administration's aggressive domestic actions, the shutdown itself, the perceived overreach of executive power, and in some cities, the deployment of federal law enforcement or National Guard troops. The No Kings theme was clearly aimed at perceived authoritarian tendencies.
How did President Trump react to millions protesting against him?
His public reaction on Sunday was dismissive and derisive. He called the protests a joke, claimed they were very small, populated by whacked-out individuals. He also repeated unsubstantiated claims that they were funded by George Soros and radical left lunatics.
Did he defend his actions?
He did, trying to frame himself as hardworking, saying, "I'm not a king. I work my ass off to make our country great."
But the response wasn't just verbal, was it? There was that digital aspect, too.
Right. Late on Saturday night, the president shared a video on his social media platforms, an AI-generated video.
What did it show?
It was striking. It depicted an AI version of King Trump wearing a crown, piloting a fighter jet set to the theme music from Top Gun: Danger Zone. And the jet was shown flying over Times Square, dumping a stream of brown liquid, clearly implied to be feces, onto CGI representations of the No Kings demonstrators below.
Wow. A sitting president sharing a video depicting that against citizens protesting.
It's a stark illustration of the breakdown in traditional political norms and rhetoric. A very aggressive, digitally rendered counterattack against First Amendment expression.
Interestingly, Speaker Johnson actually tried to use the protests to make a different point, didn't he?
He did. He offered a bit of rhetorical judo, saying, "If President Trump was a king, the government would be open right now." His argument was that the very existence of the shutdown, the legislative gridlock, proved that checks and balances were working, and that Trump didn't have unchecked power.
Using the governing failure as proof of constitutional success. An interesting take.
A very political spin, certainly.
Okay, one more significant executive action from this period. Clemency. There was a controversial commutation.
Yes, involving the former Congressman George Santos. On Friday, President Trump commuted Santos's 7-year federal prison sentence.
Santos, the one convicted of wire fraud and identity theft. Who had only recently started his sentence.
That's the one. He had only reported to prison back in July, so he served maybe 3 months or so before the commutation came through.
What was Santos's reaction?
By Sunday, he was out and speaking publicly. He said he was humbled by his brief prison experience and planned to focus on prison reform advocacy. He also made a point of saying he wouldn't run for office again for at least a decade. And he tried to deflect criticism, suggesting it was unfair for the media to press his former Republican colleagues about the commutation.
Did that work? Did his former colleagues stay quiet?
Not entirely. The commutation drew immediate and sharp criticism from some key Republicans, especially those from New York who had pushed hard for Santos to be expelled from the House in the first place.
Like who?
Representative Nicole Malliotakis, for instance. She called it flat out the wrong decision. She didn't mince words, saying Santos stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from his donors.
So it wasn't universally popular even within the GOP. Raises questions about the use of clemency powers.
Absolutely. It fueled ongoing debates about whether presidential pardons and commutations are sometimes used more for political loyalty or to protect allies rather than solely based on justice or mercy.
Okay, we've covered a massive amount of ground across these 48 hours. Let's try to synthesize this for everyone listening. What are the big picture economic and social consequences of all these interlocking events, the shutdown, the RIF threat, the EO, the international tension?
Well, domestically, the most immediate and perhaps lasting consequence is the damage to federal worker morale and the very real risk of a long-term brain drain.
How so?
When you combine the threat of permanent, politically motivated layoffs like the RIFs with a new hiring system under EO 14356 that explicitly prioritizes political alignment over expertise, you send a chilling message throughout the federal workforce.
A message being?
That expertise isn't valued, maybe even seen as a liability, and that political loyalty is now the key to survival and advancement. That kind of climate is toxic for morale.
And it makes talented people leave.
It guarantees it. Highly skilled scientists, engineers, economists, regulators, diplomats, people with options in the private sector or academia, many will look at this environment and decide it's not worth it. They'll leave. And it becomes incredibly difficult to recruit top talent into government service under these conditions.
Leaving the government less capable over time.
Severely less capable. You lose that deep expertise needed to handle complex issues, from pandemics to financial crises to climate change to national security threats. It hollows out the government's ability to function effectively.
And the immediate economic impact.
It's multifaceted. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers and contractors not getting paid instantly pulls billions of dollars in consumer spending out of the economy, hurting businesses nationwide. That's the direct shutdown impact.
And the international instability adds another layer.
Yes. The threat of sudden tariffs on a major trading partner like Colombia, or the general uncertainty created by unpredictable foreign policy actions, adds significant risk and instability to the global economic picture. Businesses hate uncertainty.
So if you put it all together,
what you see is the entire U.S. system, the checks and balances between branches, the institutions themselves being placed under extreme, almost simultaneous pressure. It's not really governance as problem solving. It's more like governance by crisis.
Which is inefficient and damaging.
Fundamentally inefficient, economically damaging, and deeply corrosive to the public's trust in the idea of a competent, impartial, professional government. That trust is hard to rebuild once it's lost.
It really has been an exhaustive look. We've seen how a legislative failure, its shutdown, wasn't just allowed to happen, but was actively, it seems, weaponized by the executive branch.
Weaponized to achieve these deeper structural political goals, whether through the immediate shock of those RAF notices.
Or the long-term control mechanism built into Executive Order 14356 for hiring.
Or by aggressively testing the limits of executive power on the world stage with the strikes in the Caribbean and that extraordinary confrontation with Colombia.
And all while battling institutional checks like the one imposed by the judiciary with that TRO.
Exactly. Which brings us, I think, to the final really provocative thought we should leave with you, our listeners.
Go ahead.
If the strategic objective, as strongly suggested by actions like the RIF strategy and the architecture of EO 14356, is indeed to systematically dismantle or politicize significant parts of the regulatory and administrative state, what happens next?
What specific functions are at risk?
Think about the essential, often invisible, functions, the routine food safety inspections that prevent outbreaks, the long-term, highly technical work needed to maintain the nuclear stockpile safely and reliably, the environmental monitoring that tracks pollution, the financial oversight meant to prevent meltdowns. What happens when these functions are degraded, hollowed out, or steered by political loyalty instead of expertise?
How long until the public feels the effects?
That's the core question, isn't it? How long would it take for you, for the average citizen, to feel the real-world consequences, maybe in ways you don't even immediately connect back to these decisions of a federal government that's been deliberately hollowed out and politicized? That's the long shadow cast by the events of this single chaotic weekend.
A truly critical and frankly sobering analysis of the federal government operating under quite unprecedented strain. Thank you for helping us navigate all of that complexity today.
My pleasure. Always important to track these details.
We'll see you next time for another deep dive.